I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a food company known for its granolas and natural cereals. Kelly and Brendan started the company in their early 20s, and Bare Naked is available nationwide in stores like Whole Foods and Costco and online at barenaked.com. Welcome, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
So I wanted to start off understanding how you both met initially.
Well, I think it was back in the hallways of our middle school in Darien, Connecticut. He was actually selling candy out of his locker, and we weren't exactly best of friends in middle school. And then I remember getting an invitation to your graduation party senior year. And I was so flattered, and because I was a year younger, and I was being invited to celebrate his graduation. And I remember that party just kind of being a blast and being a little bit sad that you were going off to college.
And then for like 4 years in college, or 5 years, 6 years, probably, we didn't even see each other.
No.
Maybe like once or twice.
Kelly, what did you do between college and starting Bare Naked in 2002?
I sort of dabbled in a couple of different sports marketing internships. I've worked for Sports Illustrated at the Australian Olympics, and then again in Salt Lake City for the Winter Olympics. I looked at it from a long-term standpoint and recognized that it wasn't going to be fulfilling 5-10 years down the road. And in order for me to get the level of satisfaction I wanted out of a career and out of life, I looked myself in the eye and said, you got to do something else.
And why granola?
Granola was something that I made for myself simply because I believed in the fact that if I ate it, I'd feel better and I'd perform better. I intuitively, I think, have always understood that there is a real connection between what I eat and how I feel and how I function. So to that end, I just really relied on eating healthy foods in college. And the granola was actually one of those foods that I made myself.
And Brendan, what were you doing from college until you started Bare Naked?
I graduated in 2000. I went, and that was kind of during the tech boom, so I went to work for a software company in Austin, Texas.
Where did you go to college, by the way?
Vanderbilt.
Okay.
Worked at a company called Trilogy Software, which was so fun. They recruited like 200 kids out of college. It was like the prototypical tech boom where we had like ski boats we could go on. They had parties every week for us, but we did no work. And so we all had a very good time, but they eventually laid us off. So I came back up to New York, and then I went to work for Saturday Night Live. And I worked in the talent department there. And then I was on hiatus from SNL from the summer, and that's when I ran into Kel and heard the name Bare Naked. And I was like, oh, brilliant. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
And so at what point, Kelly, when you said, okay, I want to start this business, did you think, you know what, I want to bring Brendan on board as my co-founder? How did that work?
I think I was about 8 to 10 weeks into making batches, putting it on the shelves of local stores, and I was baking it through the night and then delivering the next day. So I would wheel in all of my ingredients into the back of a local kitchen, which was a commercially certified kitchen space. So I would do that at about 8 p.m., bake until 1 or 2 in the morning, and then turn around and sell everything I had made the night before the next day. Truthfully, it was getting to be really tiring. I wanted to be able to share some of the work and also some of the excitement. When I ran into Brendan, he was the first person who really expressed raw enthusiasm for what I was doing. Mm. At that point, it was so in its infancy, and I got more raised eyebrows than I did good looks. He was really the first person who said, can I come to the kitchen with you? And that seemed really strange that someone would want to come to the kitchen at night when they could be going to a local bar with friends. And then the next day it was, well, let's go on a sales call together. Let's go to local stores and pitch to organic and natural markets, farmers markets. We did that.
I was like, why are you doing it this way? Let's do it this way. You're wasting so much time. Well, you know, let's go to Walmart. Let's buy some bins. Let's set up an assembly line. It was addictive because every day you would put in this work and you'd come up with this new idea, and it made your life easier and it made the business bigger and it made the concept a greater idea. And it was so exhilarating.
Yeah,
for
it was
first
a rush because we were growing so quickly. I mean, we were getting new stores every day, and I was able to use to focus on the things that I was good at, and I recognized instantly what he was the areas where he was talented, and those complemented each other really nicely without it being much of a planned effort.
this, in a way, seems like a marriage of convenience, in that, like, you both knew each other from high school, and, oh, it's just so convenient we happened to run into each other at this time. But what were some of your concerns at the time about Brendan coming on board as a partner?
It became clear when we started working together that he had a very strong personality and that he was really opinionated.
It becomes clear in the 2 minutes of this radio show, in fact.
Before that, it wasn't so obvious. He is very resourceful. I always think that's one of his best characteristics. He'll get something no matter what the cost. And I'm a little more reserved than that. So I appreciated the ambition, and I thought to myself, this could be a really complementary partnership. At times, I think, you know, he did stretch the company to a point that it became sort of a stressful state. But it's amazing the way that people in our organization acted so well under the stress, and how it was almost a motivating mechanism. And
every
we
year
figure
we
out a way to do it.
Yeah,
every year.
Every year we've consistently beat it.
When you saw that he was super aggressive, did you say to your parents, you know what, I'm not so sure he's the right person for this?
Everybody
or what was that dynamic?
Everybody said not to partner.
Yeah, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We were warned. I think we were warned independently, and then we were warned together not to go down this partnership road.
After we had kind of decided that we wanted to partner up, we would go to the local people in our area and say, you know, can we help? You're an expert in marketing. Can we talk to you about it? Can you help us out? And they're like, you're partners? Like, I don't even want to talk to you. Like, you guys are going to blow up in 6 months. Get out of here.
Why were they opposed to it?
Kelly and I have been blessed for whatever reason to be able to work through it. I mean, we've had our struggles. There's no doubt about it. It's a relationship,
sure.
Right? And it's no different than a marriage or a father and son or friends. And the only times we've ever gotten really in trouble is when we stopped talking.
When was that?
Oh, it was 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And we put our company through, you know, when you have, we have about 32 people in our company today. And when you, and we lead the company and we're the faces of the company. And when we're not stable, everybody feels it. They can sense it in your actions and your emotions and how you look at each other. And so we have to be very sensitive to that. You never want to fight in front of your children, right? I mean, it's an age old rule. And I think we've tried to do the best to kind of suppress some of our own needs in the hopes of that we would project a better image to the organization and, you know, to our employees.
Yet still children and employees pick up the body language.
Yeah, and the vibes that we send out, even though we don't intend to and we don't want to, they naturally get picked up by those that are in offices next door to us and just the organization at large.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a healthy snacking company that sells granolas and natural cereals to places like Whole Foods and Costco's around the country. What's an example of something that you disagreed vehemently about?
Can I go?
Where do you want to begin?
We were designing our website, and again, that was Brendan's idea. I thought that we didn't need to invest in a website so quickly. I thought it was more important for the product to be available in stores, but he was very pro developing a website and getting that launched. So I agreed to it, and we decided that it would be best if we put pictures of ourselves up on the website to show our consumers that there really are people behind this whole enterprise and that it's real and authentic.
Well, and we knew very early on that we could never compete with Kellogg's or anybody like that, and so we needed to build our identity into the brand.
So in terms of, you know, pictures and images that really represented us best, I wanted to go take pictures down at a beach.
You originally wanted to take, like, pictures of, like, nuts and fruits and stuff and stick it on there.
That's right. And then, as well, if we were going to use pictures of ourselves, we should be in the great outdoors. And Brendan wanted to position ourselves in such a light that was, quote-unquote, bare naked, which involved showing a little bit of skin, and there was nothing offensive about it, but I wasn't totally comfortable with it. And he thought it was a brilliant way to sort of market the company?
I just wanted a response and wanted it to be memorable. Your idea was to, like, wear vests and wear no T-shirts underneath the vests. Like, that doesn't get anybody's attention.
So Brendan won that little argument because on the website, you guys are kind of bare from sort of the chest up.
We just wanted our consumers to ask the question.
Well, I'm sure your consumers also ask the question whether or not you've ever dated. So have
We're
you?
Talking business here, not personal
we
stuff.
We are, but it's all interwoven, as you know.
Should we tell her?
You can go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. We are friends with Bare Naked Benefits.
Yes.
I haven't said that in ages.
That's very well said. I like that bon mot. But what does that mean? Does that mean that you have dated or that you are dating or have they intertwined at all?
I date Kelly's best friend from high school. And I've been dating her since Bare Naked started.
Since 2 weeks after Bare Naked started.
Well, at least we got that off the table.
For anyone who's wondering.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a healthy snacking company that sells granolas and natural cereals to places like Whole Foods and Costco's around the country. So I want to go back to the Bare Naked beginning. When, Kelly, you said that you were in a commercial kitchen, how did you find that commercial kitchen?
It was actually just a friend of a friend who owned the facility, and it was the back of a local market in Rowayton, Connecticut. As soon as I realized I wanted to, you know, put the wheels in motion and get this business off the ground, I called the state of Connecticut, and I said, do I need to be approved? Do I need a license? And they said, well, you have to cook in a commercially certified kitchen space. That's kind of the number one rule if you want to get products on the shelf. And we were in that kitchen for about 6 months before we outgrew it.
Did that kitchen make you take yourself more seriously, or did you feel that you became more disciplined because you knew that you could only work from, what were your hours?
It was about 8 or 9 p.m. to about
2 or 3 in the
morning. 2 in the morning. In terms of professionalism, I felt like it was real. And being in that kitchen at night with the clock ticking, and I had to get, you know, 50 pounds out the door that night, It was a rush, and I remember those moments being really, really sweet. I had the radio on, I had my 50 pounds of oats, and, you know, pots and pans were banging around in the kitchen. It was bliss. There were nights that were just wonderful. And you feel like, you know, I'm making this food, and I'm going to feed someone.
From purchasing the products, physically making them with your own hands, taking it to the store yourself in your own car, putting it on the shelves with your own hands, feeding it to the consumer at the store, and then them taking it home was just it was such a wonderful kind of cycle to be in. And I think back to those moments of being in the kitchen with the music blaring at night at 12 o'clock when all our friends are calling us from the bars, and we were having so much fun.
What was the music you were listening to?
Dave Matthews, Coldplay, Counting Crows.
My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, co-founders of Bare Naked. We'll hear more from Brendan and Kelly coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott, the co-founders of Bare Naked, a food company known for its granolas and natural cereals. Kelly and Brendan started the company in their early 20s, and Bare Naked is available nationwide in stores like Whole Foods and Costco and online at barenaked.com. You were the initial employees in the company. It was just the two of you doing everything. But what did that really mean?
Early on, when it was just he and I mean, we were the distributors. We were the brokers. We sold. We made the product. We did the accounting. We cleaned our offices when we had one. We were it. And that sometimes requires 7 days a week worth of work up until 11 o'clock at night when you just don't want to look at another oat. You know, you've got to keep baking. I remember a lot of times we go to running races in the area, and when athletes finish the race, we're there at the finish line to feed them some Bare Naked and re-energize them. And so that entails, obviously, bringing a ton of product, sample cups, spoons, coolers of yogurt, banners, balloons. We really want to create a fun environment for these folks after they finish a race. Brendan had a 1983 Jeep and didn't have a top at this point. So what we did is we filled the Jeep with all of the materials we needed in order to make this a successful marketing event, and it didn't all fit. So instead of, you know, getting a top for the Jeep like we should have, we shrink-wrapped the car with stretch wrap and drove down the 95 across New York City into Long Island with a stretch-wrap vehicle.
That's great.
I vividly remember going over the Whitestone Bridge with, like, the Jeep totally filled up, and it was so loud because of all the stretch-wrapping and people, like, honking their horn next to me, saying, like, when it was pointing at it, thinking it was going to fall off.
And then that night, I think, sleeping either four or five employees to a room. I mean, we used every inch of space that we had.
In the beginning, out of our first seven employees, six of which went to Darien High School. The seventh was my college roommate. And so, you know, for the first two or three years, I mean, it was seven college kids just on the road going to have a good time. And we'd be five or six in a room, you know, going up to Rochester for an event. And then we'd all, you know, work all day, go have a good time that night, and then go pile in the car, go to Buffalo. And it was like a two-year road
trip. It was really fun. The most impact when we were on the road. And there was only so much we could do Monday through Friday, but Saturday and Sunday were the days that we just nailed it. We got to see consumers. We got to go to retailers. Occasionally the press would come to the event and we got to see those folks. And that's when the action happened.
How much do you think your age has helped in terms of setting yourself apart? Like, oh, wow, those kids were only 23 when they started it.
I think it was a big asset for us. I think people really felt when they saw our passion and saw our enthusiasm, saw how hard we were willing to work, they were willing to help us.
And we were so green, I think they just really wanted to help.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we never really bought any capital equipment for the first 2.5 years. We would go in and we'd call all the different local people and say, hey, listen, if you have capital equipment and you're not using it 24 hours a day, can we use it at night and we'll pay you and it's just extra money for you guys? And that's how we made all of our product for the first 2 years.
And I remember one day when we were operating the business out of my parents' house, we were going to make several batches of granola that night. And so we ordered in a bunch of food from a distributor. The truck showed up in my parents' driveway and they unloaded, instead of raisins and almonds, they unloaded dog food and tofu. And we were like, what are we going to do? We can't use either of these products. So back to, you know, Wild Oats we went, and we were emptying all the bulk bins in the center aisle, making sure we had just enough raw materials to get through that production run. So we really had to kind of turn over every stone in order to get it done.
And on the raw materials front, distributors wouldn't sell us ingredients because we didn't have good credit and we weren't a big enough customer. So we're like, well, how do we get almonds? How do we get honey? So we used to go to the local Costco and literally we would go out, we'd have those big carts and fill the entire thing up with almonds or the entire thing up with honey or canola oil and be pushing the cart out the door and got the weirdest looks from everybody. They're like, do you bathe in that stuff?
Both of us to push the cart.
I mean, pushing like 500 pounds of honey out the door, and we ended up being like the Costco, you know, business of the month or
business
customer
member
of the month.
Of the month.
We used to buy so much stuff.
Awesome. And by the way, you know, this dog food with tofu delivery might just be another Bare Naked product for pets.
There you go.
I want to talk about your first customer. How did you break into the market on a large scale?
I think the first couple customers that we had were really, really small independent customers. And basically, the fact that we used to go buy sandwiches there when we were kids and that we used to buy groceries there got us onto the store shelves there, and we made it work. And then our first big jump was to a place called Stu Leonard's, which is a three-store chain in the New York metro market. And it's this great, wonderful, innovative supermarket. And that was going to be our first big break. And the way we got in there is we called the buyer for months and months and months saying, hey, listen, we're local. Give us a chance. We used to shop here as kids. You know, got no love. And then we eventually just kind of decided one day we're going to bring the buyer breakfast in bed. Because we're like, how do we get his attention? And so Kelly and I got up one morning very early, like 6:30 in the morning, and got like her mom's tray and her mom's china and got some fresh fruit and some Stu Leonard's yogurt and some Stu Leonard's milk, and we wore matching jean and t-shirt outfits that said Bare Naked. I mean, just so cheesy.
We were the first car in the parking lot that morning. We were the first ones up in the office.
And we get up to the office and we're like, hey, you know, is the buyer here? We brought him breakfast. And the receptionist's like, well, that's really cute, guys, but he's actually on vacation. And we were just like so deflated. But then at that moment, Stu Leonard Jr. walked by and we're like, Stu, we brought you breakfast. And we shoved the tray in front of him, and he spent a couple hours with us that morning, took on the product. And then when he took on the product, I remember it was in May of 2003, for about 3 weeks straight, 5 days every week, I went to Stu Leonard's and sold the product myself to the consumers. So it was really important to us that once we got in that first opportunity, that we wanted to, you know, you make the sale really one time, and then after that, you're really just selling your prior success. So we made the sale to Stu Leonard's, and we did everything in our power to make sure it was a raging success there, because that raging success then led to a local newspaper article about our success at Stu Leonard's, which led to the next chain following.
You're right. It's one thing to get into the store, and then it's another to really nurture it so that you perform well, because he would kick you off the shelf as quickly as he allowed you on.
So many food companies I see fail, and they fail because of that reason. They think they get on the store shelf, and they think they're done.
It's like you got to be careful when you get married. You still got to work at it. It's not like just because you have the ring on your finger, it's done.
Of course. Even, you know, the Stu Leonard's break was a lucky one. I think it was right at the point where we needed something to happen in the business. But the coolest thing about Stu's was also the fact that it was really our classroom for learning about the food business. I spent time on the loading dock. I worked with the managers. I even backed up a U-Haul truck myself and unloaded product. And it was just neat to see the process from A to Z, how you sell a product into a grocery store and how it ultimately gets on the store shelf.
Because we are so cash strapped and because we had no success and because we were starting from scratch, it forced us to kind of crawl on our hands and knees along the whole process and really learn it backwards and forwards, which allowed us, as we got larger, to kind of understand what levers to pull within those organizations to get Make Bare Naked successful.
Were there ever any potential customers who were trying your food that said, you know, I don't really like this? Like, what was some of the customer feedback?
Oh, we got rejection left and right. I mean, and when we were in the stores, I would never say, do you want to try some whole grain granola? I would say, do you want to get Bare Naked? And, you know, they'd say, what's Bare Naked? I'd say, well, it's the best way to start your day. Well, what do you mean? And I'd say, well, give it a try. And then, you know, then let's talk about it. And because granola had such a negative connotation, and, you know, it was kind of think of Birkenstocks and Vermont or something like that. And so we had such a different spin on granola. We never wanted to call it granola. We wanted to call it Bare Naked. But consumers, when we were launching the product, it was right during the Atkins boom. And so everyone's like, oh, I can't have any carbs. And I'd sit there and be like, you're going to die if you don't eat carbs. Like, you need to eat fats and you need to eat carbs. Just eat the right ones and be smart about it and exercise.
Did you ever put off anybody, like an 85-year-old grandmother, when you said you want to get Bare Naked?
I think they were the most excited. Nobody said it to them in a while.
I'm Jessica Harrison. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are the co-founders of Bare Naked, Kelly Flatley and Brendan Sinnott. What is the history of granola?
The first,
back to the 1800s.
Yeah, Dr. Kellogg from Kellogg Cereal. The first cereal he ever invented was actually called Grunola, which was a baked blend of grains with honey. And that was the first cereal. And then for whatever reason, for the last 100 years, people have ruined cereal and processed it too much and put too much sugar on it. So we're trying to take it back to its roots.
So your packaging makes you stand out to some degree. It's very bold, and it's in these fitted bags. Was that something you knew you wanted from the beginning, or what was that process like?
I think early on, when Kelly originally packaged the product, she had it in a clear cellophane package, and the product looked so beautiful. But after kind of twist tying about 1,000 twist ties a night and then hand tying little hay pieces on there, it got a little old. So we eventually found something that had a zipper on the top of it that was clear. And we're like, oh, that's perfect, because, you know, we wanted the consumers to actually be able to see the product, which is very different than a lot of other cereals. They get hidden in boxes.
And I think the package also accurately reflects what Bare Naked values. We're simple. It's clean. The ingredient declaration is everything that you can pronounce. There's a message from Brendan and I on the back of every bag. So, we're accessible people. It's bold, it's refreshing, it stands out, it's youthful, and I think those are all things by which you can describe Bare Naked.
I want to turn to capital. How did you guys pay yourself for the first 2 years of the business?
We didn't. And we for the first 2 years, that was kind of the big sacrifice. We were able to do it because we both moved back in with our parents. And so for the first literally 2 years, we didn't pay ourselves maybe about $500 a year.
One retailer actually paid us in cash, $100, and we split it. I was like, this is our annual salary. We got $50.
Because we were so young, we had no real responsibility except to ourselves. We didn't have to take care of any kids, house payments, car payments, anything like that. We totally mooched from our parents. We utilized credit card debts. I remember I was doing the accounting for the company on QuickBooks, which I still don't understand to this day. And consistently in the checking account column, it was just negative like $110,000, negative $130,000 every day because I wasn't balancing everything properly. And we were overdrawn from the bank. And we had a great local banker that, you know, we'd call up and say, hey, Tom, I promise we're doing okay, but can you just let this check clear? And it was those kinds of relationships that let us get by.
Which credit card company were you using?
Which one weren't we using? We American Express, Visa, MasterCard, all of them. The big thing that we did is we would rack up all these bills, and then we didn't have any money to pay for them. But what's so wild is the credit card companies, after the first of the year, because so many people spend a lot of money during the holiday season, offer 0% financing if you transfer balances.
Ah.
So we would always do a big transfer of all the balances in the beginning in January or February.
Look at you. And was this your personal credit card or now the company's credit card?
No, this was all Kelly Flatley's credit card. I don't think you had good enough credit to get us
I had plenty
card.
Of it. It was ruined pretty quickly afterwards, but we had it. And to this day, our name's still on the hook for all the loans that we have.
What were your parents feeling about this? I mean, it's one thing to say, yeah, go ahead, start this little adventure, but then to eat away at your credit, which really stays with you for life, you know, did they feel differently?
You don't tell them those things. I mean, I had savings, and I think I had, you know, maybe $8,000 in savings from my prior jobs, burned through all of it. I cashed all my savings bonds that my mom had given me as a child, and I cashed those. I never told her about it. But it was just like you needed some spending money. You needed to go out to dinner once in a while.
Did you flirt with venture capital at any point?
We did. We were actually, flirt's a good word for it, because we almost started dating with those folks. We sort of entered into discussions with them, and 30 days after we started talking to them, we had a real good understanding of how they would impact our business and what it would mean to us personally and professionally. And we were almost about to close the deal with them. And then I actually remember we sat down in your mom's living room next to the fireplace. And he looked at me and I looked at him and I was like, can we do this? Are we ready for it? Is it the right thing? And we just had to ask ourselves really, really deep, difficult questions. And, you know, the crux of which was, are we ready to give up control? And we both realized that the money wasn't worth it.
And at that point, we said no to the venture capitalists. And then they came back to us 2 months later and said, oh, we'll give you twice as much money now. And so we learned the power of saying no to that point. And then I said, well, why don't I just say no again and see what happens? And so we said no. And also during that same time, we tried to seek out so much counsel from folks around us that understood financing. And we were dealing with terms. I remember going up there and negotiating with the venture capitalists, and they'd have six people around the table, and it would just be me. And they're talking about a term sheet and convertible debt and all these different technical financial instruments, which I had no idea what they were about. And, you know, some person that was close to us said, hey, Brendan, you know, the best thing in the world you can do is just say no to them and walk away. You know, you're such a success in this area. I feel confident you can go get the money from friends and family and keep your own company. And Kelly's father always says to us, you know, your ability to hold on to the company is equivalent to your tolerance for pain. And so we were willing to take a little more pain and continue with the risk and try to find the money from another source that would allow us to keep control.
Now, where did that source of capital ultimately come from if you didn't go to the venture capitalists?
It came from all friends and family. And it's been the same really group of investors that we've been able to deal with. And they've just been, you know, I think we've been very happy on both sides of the equation.
Talk to me about competition.
In retrospect, I don't think we ever picked our heads up and checked out the competitive landscape until we were asked by our investors, who are you guys up against? And we were like, well, the people next to us on the shelf. I never really given thought to who they were. I just really wanted to be on the shelf, and I thought I could outsell whoever was next to me. But it was interesting. That question was never brought up by either of us in any of our marketing discussions or anything. It was only when we were asked by people who were going to invest in our company.
So, Brendan, you're the CEO now, and Kelly, you're the president. Do people, you know, who think they have a lot of experience say, oh, you guys should turn the company over to more experienced managers because you're still in your 20s? I mean, do you face opposition? Do you say, no, I feel like I can do it? Or do you say, well, you know what, maybe they're right?
They say it every day. It fires me up. I love it. It's what kind of gets me to work every day, just to prove that I don't need your help. I can do it. But, you know, we've brought in, you know, over the last 6 months, probably 7 people, all with 10 to 15 years of experience. And what we're trying to do is just make sure we're not the smartest people in the room.
What are sales today?
Because we're private, we don't disclose our sales. Mm-hmm. But within the marketplace, people are buying this year between $75 and $100 million of bare naked from retail stores.
Now, Brendan, it's an understatement to say you have a lot of confidence, but what are some of the mistakes that you've made in the company? Give me one example.
Oh, I'll give you a big one. Big one recently is abdicating the responsibility of operations. We didn't necessarily have the right people in our operations group, and we went from operating out of one facility to 8 facilities. And I thought everything was kind of taken care of, and I didn't look at it. And operations isn't my most favorite part of my job. So I just kind of put it to the side and didn't really focus on it enough. And it's gotten us into an issue where, you know, we need to be able to make a lot of product and we don't have the ability to make it.
I think from a day-to-day standpoint, he does a really good job of keeping all the balls in the air. Sometimes his communication with the organization at large isn't perfect in terms of content and tone. And I think sometimes that has an irritating effect on some of the people. They want to know what's going on. They want to be told what's happening and when it's going to get done. And they want to be spoken to in a certain way. And I think sometimes in the haste of getting work done and meeting deadlines, he's really quick and doesn't always think right before he speaks. If that's his biggest fault, he's doing all right.
We don't mean to pick on you.
Oh, no, I love it. It's like therapy.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
My guests have been Brendan Sinnott and Kelly Flatley, co-founders of the granola company Bare Naked.
Coming up, we'll meet the painter Stephen Hanick. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the painter Stephen Hanick. Stephen is known for his luminescent landscape paintings, which he underlays with language from real life. His collectors include Sting, Tom Brokaw, and the restaurateur Danny Meyer. His paintings hang in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, among others. Welcome. Prior to becoming a painter, you were a talented ice hockey player, a goalie. How did you make the transition from ice hockey to the art world?
That's a good question. It's one of these things that where every move seems to flow into the next serendipitously. And when you look back, it you just can't quite comprehend how that happened. In my situation, my dad was a semi-pro hockey goalie and played in high school and at Williams College, and then played afterwards for a team in Lake Placid. I got into playing hockey and specifically tending goal very early on, you know, fifth, sixth grade, and in upstate New York, in Albany, New York.
And you were born in Albany?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I went to a succession of schools that had good hockey teams. It was clear that that's where my strengths lay in the hockey arena, not so much in the history classes. But after I got out of high school, these college coaches sent me to a boarding school, Deerfield Academy up in Western Massachusetts, had a very strong hockey program. It also happened to be the first year for an artist from the Cleveland Art Institute named Dan Hodomarski, who became the head of the art department there and literally turned the school upside down. This was in the late 60s, early 70s, and the culture was just ripe for all sorts of experimentation. And I always had a gift to draw, and freakishly I'm ambidextrous, so I tend to draw with both hands just as a matter of cross wires more than anything. And his response was to kick me out of class and just say, listen, you know, don't just go draw. You know, don't go draw stuff.
So he was really pivotal in nurturing your
really
talent.
Really was. And then, ironically, we really clicked after I graduated from Deerfield. I went to Bowdoin College, where I really wanted to go. They had have a very strong hockey program there. As things turned out, they did not have an art department to speak of.
It was an all-boys college at
the
time?
It was. They were just starting to have exchange students from the Seven Sisters and smaller women's colleges go spend time there. But as it turns out, after the first year, I was going to take a semester at Smith College that had a very well-established art department, and they featured an artist named Leonard Baskin, who was world-renowned and was actually on their faculty. In fact, taught a course there. I use the word teach a little carefully because he would show up whenever he felt like it. But the point is that the art department was really quite established. And, you know, I made it clear I was definitely going to come back to skate. But after being at Smith for 4 or 5 weeks, it was clear I would never go back there. It's true that having, you know, the reverse proportion of women to men, you know, was really interesting. But that's clearly not the reason why I chose to stay there. And none of my friends will believe that. So I won't bother trying to sell you that.
But it is interesting that you wanted to pursue art so much that you decided, okay, I'm going to go to an all-girls college because of their art department. And they let you in. They let you attend classes.
Right.
So you graduate from college. And then what?
Well, you know, for sanity's sake, I'd been, you know, working with athletics my whole life, and all of a sudden that stopped. And to just sort of keep things going physically, I actually got involved with playing Ultimate Frisbee, which is in its nascent stages in the early 70s. And I wound up throwing Frisbees for a living for about 10 years. Throwing Frisbees was actually paying the bills in an effort to try to solidify things that I was doing artistically.
And speaking of throwing Frisbees, I heard a story that you were living in Northampton and you had these raccoons living in your ceiling. And
yeah, I had a family of raccoons that were living upstairs in the studio where it's a crawl space. The problem being that they would, you know, piss through the ceiling, which was really, man, there's nothing like getting pissed on by a raccoon to really take the bounce out of your step on a given day. As it turns out, I actually got into this thing where I strung up these gutters, these sheets of plastic that created these aqueducts that would channel the piss into the corner into these mayonnaise jars, and I'd dump out the mayonnaise jars every couple of days or so. And in order to get them, train them to just go on the side where the aqueducts were, I was painting with phosphorescent paint in these days, and I would take a long wire and get a big glob of phosphorescent paint on the end, charge it up under the light, and put it up through holes in the ceiling, wiggle it around, and these guys would see this glowing ember, and they'd bolt for the corner, and they'd scale down the outside of the building. That's when I would grab a stack of Frisbees and run outside and pick them off the side of the building in the daylight. Getting hit by Frisbees was enough to really rattle them to the point where they learned pretty quickly to relieve themselves against the wall where the aqueducts were.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the painter Stephen Hennick, who's known mostly for his landscape paintings. What was going through your head at this time when you were painting? Were you hoping to get your painting to market and to sell some paintings to make a living, or were you just doing this for fun and making a living with your Ultimate Frisbee? What was your psychology at the time?
It was clear that my profession was going to be painting. At that particular time, I had uncovered a way of getting an unlimited range of pigments out of luminous colors, out of phosphorescent pigments, not unlike the Dayglo posters from the 60s. My breakthrough was a complete range of these pigments that were much more soothing and soft. And what these colors did was they provided a unusually vast contrast ratio. In other words, the distance between your darkest colors and your brightest colors was much more extreme than the distance between black and white. Long story short, the effect was one of remarkable three-dimensionality. Now, when you construct these compositions on huge canvases, the impact is more three-dimensional than even a movie screen, and that was a very powerful experience. The problem, of course, is that you had to see it in the dark. You had to paint it in the dark. And it required this lighting apparatus, and we required trucks to move it around. And the good side of that was that you were guaranteed one-man shows all the time because nobody else was showing in the dark. What we would do is we'd put them together in an exhibition. They would travel to art museums. They would go to college cafeterias if the student body entertainment committees would hire us. And that was marginal for about two or three years until Irene Hunter, who is primarily a dance patron. She is very active with Jacob's Pillow, Paul Taylor Dance Company, and with Mass Mocha up in North Adams, Massachusetts. She offered to basically set up an arrangement not unlike a medieval patron arrangement, where she would give me a stipend to work on, and she would take art in exchange. I was still doing a lot of woodcuts and smaller paintings, and she essentially would buy big pieces that she could never fit in her house. And then I, in return, would pay her a small fee every time I showed them.
So Irene Hunter was an unlikely ally, but she was the first among many sort of unlikely allies. You came to know these New England sisters, Agnes and Betty Mongan, and Agnes was the director of the Fog at
That's
Harvard.
Right.
How did they find you?
Betty Mongan actually founded the print and drawing department at the National Gallery, you know, decades ago. And she had just moved to the Smith College Museum. And, you know, I kept going in after class to see. She was letting me, you know, rummage through the Rembrandt etchings and just incredible access. And she goes, "Oh, you got to meet my sister, you know, Agnes, who's at Harvard. You know, let's go in there." So we travel into Cambridge. And Agnes would let me run amok through Ang drawings and stuff. These had no glass on them. No, I could have sneezed on these things very easily. But that wasn't her point. Her objective was to get me to handle the best art that they had access to, just to see how high the bar was. And needless to say, those guys set the bar very high.
Some of the people who have bought your works include Tom Brokaw, Sting, the Lauder family. How did they find you?
Well, truthfully, it was being in New York. There's no way to get around it. And that was in the early 80s.
So what did you do when you got here?
I actually got a gig modeling clothes with a friend of mine from Smith College. And they traded me studio space in return for putting on clothes and parading around for a little bit.
So you bartered your way into studio space in New York. And was your subject matter still these luminescent landscapes?
Right. I was still working with phosphorescent pigments, but because there was no space, they went from 20 feet down to 2 feet.
How do you then go about selling your paintings?
Well, two of the first people that came across my stuff and are still there today were William and Karen Lauder and Sting and Trudy Styler. Sting first saw my work through his art director, Richard Frankel, who actually owned a small study of one of my pieces. And he was quite taken back. Sting actually, he would be disappointed by you mentioning that he's a little colorblind. So he has a hard time differentiating between certain browns and greens and so forth. With the phosphorescent pigments, with light emission, he can pick up all the colors. So this was arguably the first painting he'd ever seen. And so one thing led to another, and he acquired a piece that was later reproduced in Newsweek. And by total coincidence, the woman who wrote the article heard of my work through Sting, and I wound up in this Newsweek article in 1988, I believe it was. And that was the first act of being separated from the ocean of painters out there. And it was quite serendipitous.
There was also a Fortune article about you, and the author asked Sting if generations will value your works, and I loved his response. Sting's response was, "Well, mine are going to be buried with me, so who knows?" You have a painting in Danny Meyer's restaurant, Gramercy Tavern. He's also a fan of yours. But I bring up Danny Meyer because you met a very special woman through Danny Meyer.
Right. As it turns out, that's actually a very interesting story with regard to Danny Meyer and Tom Kalicki. Tokyo, who came to a show of mine uptown at Salander O'Reilly in the early 90s. And they said, we've got this project going on. It's going to be a restaurant called the Gramercy Tavern, but we want to incorporate, you know, major art in the restaurant right from the start. And you can't believe the consultants that were down on that idea. Yeah. Said, hey, what are you doing? I mean, like, you know, it's a restaurant. It's tacky putting art in restaurants, you know. But then, you know, Larry Rivers did it. Sandra Akia was doing stuff, you know. And these were friends of mine, you know. So it just seemed like a fun thing to do.
I want to go back to this this woman.
That's an easy one. The day that Danny was taking me over to see the new space that became the restaurant, 11 Madison Park, he informed me that his assistant Bridget was going to be joining us. Well, one thing led to another, and we were actually married in that same space about 2 years after that. And that was really special.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the American painter Stephen Hanek. Stephen is known for his luminescent landscapes that have text running underneath. His collectors include Tom Brokaw, Sting, and the restaurateur Danny Meyer.
I'm interested in turning for a second to your subject matter. They're landscapes, and you're sort of a controversial figure in the contemporary art world because people perceive your work as almost too beautiful to be profound, is what somebody I've read has said. What is your answer to them?
That's a tough thing to answer, because the work you do is a direct response to the ideas that you get most excited about. Now, the fact is, I do portraiture. I do printmaking. I do a lot of work with photo assemblage. I even helped design a movie, a $100 million film.
Which, by the way, you won an Oscar for.
Right. They gave us a special effects, a special visual effects Oscar, which we're quite proud of. And the attention that I've gotten seems to have more to do with these large vistas I've been doing. And the breakthrough I have from traditional landscape is that I have text that runs through the underpainting, the armature, the drawing that holds the composition together, if you will, is actually a series of anecdotes or texts or descriptions, diaristic writing that has to do with the people that come to mind while I'm working on the vista. In other words, you know, the people mean so much more to me when I'm rendering a specific place than the topography. Yeah. And rather than just keep that in my mind, by coming out with the stories about these things, it becomes a very curious way to celebrate stories about people underneath what amounts to a set design.
Along these lines of transcription, one sort of seminal work for you is The Oxbow, after Thomas Cole of the Hudson River School. It's ironic because the one word that he has in Hebrew is the Almighty, and you sort of turn that on its head and write with people who are in your everyday life. And that's reciprocal of Cole.
That's interesting.
Cole,
I was very aware of Cole's piece when I was at Smith College. The little nook in the Connecticut River was a mile away from the Smith College Museum. Cole actually had a self-portrait in the foreground of this painting, and where he's looking back and waving at the fans. Well, Cole never lived in Northampton, and I thought it was a little, you know, out of place for him to, you know, put in, you know, his presence in this place that he never lived in. So I just started telling stories through the cornfields. You know, real people who were doing things on a daily basis that really affected our lives and everybody else's life. Mm-hmm. One of the lines that's, you know, I'm contacted about frequently through the website with regard to the piece that's at the Metropolitan Museum is on the west shore, on the northern part of the river, there's a passage that says, Gordo the Wacko almost blew Jimmy's head off with an M80. Well, it's true. It was a real life thing where this guy who just lit a firecracker that went and almost blew my friend's head off, you know. But this is real life stuff.
And how did you come about using these transcriptions in your work and alluding to people in your everyday life in your paintings?
I used to use old envelopes to soak up extra paint. I would soak up the excess paint with these envelopes and throw them away. Well, one day, I soaked up the paint and I threw it in the wastebasket, but I missed the wastebasket. And what was on the floor was better than the painting I was working on. And so I just picked it up and I just put it on the windowsill and I just let it sit there and soak into the studio for, you know, a few weeks. And I really got into this supposed waste paper with travel documentation on it. It tells you where it came from, the date that it traveled. And more often than not, there's a return address that tells you who sent it. So when you're working on that painting, you're thinking about people. You're thinking about things other than an inert object that you're putting paint on.
What part of your mind, as you were writing over your own paintings, what part of the time were you thinking, okay, my market is going to like this?
Never. Never. You don't. You really can't think about that. Anytime in any profession, you wind up doing something for the money, particularly the creative professions, you get into trouble somehow. The trouble happens either creatively or financially, but it is trouble. Whereas I found that if I stayed honest to the ideas I was excited about doing, things would work out. People would be more interested in that idea to the point where I could get backing.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate that, Jessica. Thank you.
My guest has been the painter Stephen Hanick. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.